and welcome back to another season of Match Volume. I'm your host and producer, Sadie Olson. This season, we are doing a weekly episode with a remote interview, and I can't wait to see all the amazing guests we are able to talk to without the barrier of geography. I'm going to dive right into it with our first guest, documentary filmmaker Paula Wyman-Kalman. Paula interviewed with me all the way from Israel, and I had the chance to talk to her about her film process along with her new film, Dying Doesn't Feel Like What I'm Doing.
My name's Paula Wyman-Kalman, and I'm a documentary filmmaker. It's also funny, I think it's very weird for me not to see. I'm thinking this is like the first time I've ever done an audio interview. And it's also, I mean, it's kind of like the thing that's going on with masks, right? That you can't see people's faces, facial expressions, so it's hard to respond. So I'm sort of surprised at how hard it is to talk without seeing anybody.
It is very strange because I'm used to doing it in person. So it's very strange for me as well because I get a lot of, when I interview, I get a lot from facial expression. So it's very interesting. Okay. So what was your journey into documentary filmmaking? How did you start doing this? Did you always know that you wanted to make films?
This is my favorite question. So I certainly did not always know I wanted to be a filmmaker. But the minute I picked up a camera, I knew it was what I wanted to do. So I didn't start making films until I was in my 40s. Before that, I was very academic in college. And then I rebelled against that and went to live on kibbutz. And I was a tractor driver. And I loved the physical work. I loved doing something that, you know, changed the world, that felt really just physical. And then my husband, Levi, was invited to be a rabbi in West London. And as soon as I knew we were going to London, I applied to social work school and film school. And I got accepted to both. And I thought, well, what's more physical? Film is just much more physical than social work, but I did love social work. So I went to film school, but then decided that I wanted to make films that were like social work that helped people. So I began working in a film archive where actually I just watched films for a lot of years until Sony came up with cameras that were small enough for me to be a filmmaker on my own. So I could take the camera and record people's lives in a kind of social worky kind of way. So I started filming almost birthday cards for people, or, you know, little films for people's 80th birthdays. And one of the first commissions I got I had a friend in America, Rachel Cowan, who you will hear more about later because she's the subject of the film that I'm presenting. I made a birthday card for Rachel Cowan, who was in America, but had many friends in Israel. And I filmed all of her friends saying happy birthday to her. And one of the friends was a woman named Alice Shalvey, who's an iconic, legendary feminist figure in Israel. And a friend in America, Jeannie Ungerleiter from the Darot Foundation, saw Alice Shalvey saying happy birthday to Rachel and came to me and said, why don't you make a documentary about Alice Shalvey? Now, that was a huge leap from doing, sort of birthday cards to doing a documentary movie, but I was incredibly fortunate that smaller cameras had been made that enabled me to film broadcast quality on a camera on my own. And I followed Alice for a year. So it was kind of like it was just an amazing experience because I could, you know, just take my camera around. I filmed, you know, hundreds of hours. And so it was a beautiful introduction to documentary filmmaking because I could just flow with her in her life. And then I found an amazing editor, Hila Waldman, who is still a very close friend, who helped me shape the film. And miraculously, that first film was broadcast as an ABC TV special, I think mainly because Alice was such an amazing person.
And what was that film called?
That was called, well, it's funny, it was called the Annotated Alice, but when ABC bought it, they changed the title to Rites of Passage. But I like the name Annotated Alice because I think it's a sweeter title. And also a couple years ago, I made a film called The Reannotated Alice, where the first film had been Alice at 70, and the next film was Alice at 90. So it was amazing getting to film her again.
Yeah. So how did that feel to see your first documentary film from beginning to end, knowing that you had made all of the pieces kind of fit together?
I can't describe the amazing feeling putting it together. It's just like, it's so rich. And one of the things I love to do is gather archival material to weave in. So it's really like recreating someone's life, but or retelling the narrative in a way that lets other people see into their hearts and let them see themselves in a better way. And it just, it's so satisfying.
That's actually a question. Kind of a technical question I have about documentary filmmaking, especially when I was watching Dying Doesn't Feel Like What I'm Doing. That film, like the film of her at when she was young at summer camp, is that actually her, or do you find that in archives?
It is completely 100% actually her. And her family had, hours and hours of film. And we did the most wonderful afternoon where I borrowed a film projector and showed the films to her and her sisters. And it was such a beautiful, they were so happy and I was so happy. And that's her. It's an ideological question in, documentary filmmaking, if you'll use footage that could be your character but isn't. But I like, as much as possible to use real footage.
But in general, is that practiced where they would use footage that isn't the person but fits the story?
Well, it's really interesting. I went to a session on ethics with National Geographic, and they were saying that if you can film a bird finding a worm and a bird feeding a worm to a baby bird, but it doesn't have to be the same bird, but it has to be that it could be the same bird. So I suppose you could say if you had a civil rights march, you could show the civil rights march even if Rachel wasn't in that actual march. But I happen to have pictures of Paul actually in the civil rights marches. All of the photographs in the film that don't contain Rachel were taken by Rachel, because she was a photographer.
That's very cool. All of the films, at least that I have kind of looked into of yours, have a theme, which is like modern Jewish issues. Is there a reason that you chose to cover this, or is it just kind of what you're passionate about?
I think it's totally that I have a very small, radius of where I like to film, and it's very easy. I living in Jerusalem and I'm married to a rabbi, it's kind of what is what I'm surrounded with. So I have a dream of making a film on the first female Buddhist monk ordained in Thailand.
That's very cool.
Yes. And actually, at one time I had dreamt of making a film of her and Rachel because they were both grandmothers running retreat centers. And I dragged Rachel to Thailand to to meet Dhammananda, and there's some clips of it in the film, but
I saw that. Yes, with the idea of merging Western and Eastern. She said that this is the century where Western or Eastern ideas kind of merge with Western ideas. I thought that was very cool.
I'm so curious. You know, you might be the first person I'm talking to who's seeing the film who doesn't come from a very similar background to mine. So what did you think of the film?
I loved it. I actually finished watching it this morning and I cried, but I thought it was fantastic. And you couldn't have chose a more genuine and inspiring person to do something like that on. Someone that doesn't come from a Jewish background, I thought it was very, just like a very genuine look into, kind of the community and the way that she, Rachel, interacted with her community. I thought it was very special and cool.
Oh, I'm so moved to hear you say that. I'm so moved because a big worry was that it would be accessible to as many people as possible. And, that's why I'm so happy you're doing this podcast, and hopefully it will open up more of the world to Rachel.
Right. Yeah, I didn't finish it. I only saw the first few minutes of it, and I plan on finishing it, but of Fringes. And I thought that was also a very cool kind of look into just the area and the difference, like, I don't know. Do you want to talk about Fringes a little bit?
Oh, that was so much fun to make. I went to three different communities. I actually went to more communities, but in the end, there's only three in the film, and followed them over the course of the year. And they were each very young, innovative Jewish communities. One was a secular yeshiva in Jerusalem. Which means that they studied religious sources, but from a non-religious point of view. Another was an organic farm in Virginia, where the wife was the daughter of refugees from the former Soviet Union, and her husband Pablo was a convert. And the other was a young shul synagogue in Montreal called the Ghetto Shul, and they're all exploring ways of being organically Jewish in the modern world. And just everything was so personal. Everything, they all have, you know, little kids, and the question of how you teach things to your kids. And I just got totally involved with them all, and I'm still involved with them all, and they're doing really well and still really doing interesting things.
Okay, so let's dive into Dying Doesn't Feel Like What I'm Doing. So like I said, I just watched it. It was fantastic. So this is your newest film that just came out this year. Do you want to talk about it a little bit, kind of like your process and how you came up with the idea?
Okay. So, as I said, Rachel, the first film I ever was commissioned to do was a birthday video of Rachel's friends in Israel saying happy birthday to her in America. And that led to, other things. But I always in the back of my mind thought, well, it would be great to make a movie about Rachel. I actually interviewed her for Fringes because Rachel was a convert, and I was interested in her experience. I interviewed her. I made a film on American Jews' relationship to Israel, and I interviewed Rachel. I always was interviewing her, and, you know, when I would visit, I would film her with her grandkids, or I loved filming her. And I filmed her with Dhammananda in Thailand. But I always felt like I had, you know, all the time in the world to make a film about her. So I wasn't really in a hurry. But then she retired. Her life is incredible. She was active in the civil rights movement, met her husband, became interested in Judaism, converted to Judaism, became a rabbi. And the year before she was ordained as a rabbi, her incredible husband, Paul Cowan, who is just larger than life. But I won't go down that path here, though. His brother Jeffrey is going to be speaking at the on the screening that we're doing in California. But she then was one of the founders of the Institute of Jewish Spirituality, and then got very involved in Wise Aging, writing a book with Linda Thal. So she was about to really retire. And I thought, okay, so now she's really going to have time. So I'm going to do this film on her. And she was so sweet. She goes, I know you really want to do this, and I'll do this as a favor to you. And then she kind of came around and said, you know, I really feel lucky that you want to do this. So we had incredible plans. I was already training. Every summer she led meditation workshops in Alaska, and I was training to do kayaking so I could go on the workshop with her. And she was going to come to Israel on an encounter tour to learn more about Palestinians. And it was going to be an incredible film. And then she was diagnosed with glioblastoma. I just, you know, hopped on a plane, and I had no idea if she would want to continue with the filming. But I saw her, you know, maybe 10 days after her surgery, and she said that she did want to continue with the filming because she felt like she wouldn't have to write a memoir if I was filming. And she was so generous in letting me, you know, be with her through everything she was going through, because she really felt it was like sort of her last mission to show people, you know, how to live well with dying.
So how did you meet Rachel? When did you guys become friends?
Oh, that's my husband's late father, Wolf Kelman, was a prominent rabbi on the Upper West Side who actually lived across the street from Rachel and Paul. And Rachel and Paul, if you want to know more about their story, Paul wrote a book called An Orphan in History, which sort of traces finding their way back to Judaism. So they got close to Wolf and my mother-in-law, Jackie, and they would. So when Levi and I were living in Israel, when we came back, we would meet them at Wolf and Jackie's, and they had an amazing place at Martha's Vineyard. We would visit them at Martha's Vineyard. And then when Paul passed away, Rachel began working at the Cummings Institute. She was the director of Jewish Life, and through that she started coming to Israel more. I remember we went on a retreat together and went whitewater rafting together. And that was sort of something that broke through, because she was, she was so charismatic. And so I was a little intimidated by her, but I rapidly felt like she was the most incredible listener in the world. You could just talk to her and she made you feel like your life was so meaningful. I know that she made many, many people feel that way, but it doesn't make it any less. You know, it's just a wonderful characteristic that she had.
Yeah, I think one of the most beautiful shots you have of her is that with the rainbow umbrella, and she's kind of like skipping through the street. And I think that really kind of shows her personality really well.
Oh, that was incredible. That's in front of my house in Jerusalem. And it was like, you know, 20 years ago, and she was doing it. And I just said, I just got to get my camera. Look at you. You're dancing with a rainbow umbrella.
So while you were working on this film, did your vision change as you made it? Or was it kind of like you knew the shots that you wanted, you knew how you wanted it to look? Like, how did that process go?
Well, there was the radical change from in the beginning when it was first just going to be a life adventure to when it became clear that it was going to be a sort of end of life adventure. But I never know what a film's going to look like. I always film, and then create the shape in the editing room, which is why it takes me, we edited the film for more than a year. Because I think it is kind of like social work, that you take the whole, as much material as possible, and then go through it looking for meaning.
Right. And so how do you choose what to shoot? How do you know what your shots are that are going to make the narrative special?
It's like a dance. Like, you're sort of like looking. And so on this, quite often I do all of the filming on my own. As Rachel became sicker, I had the feeling it was, emotionally, so it was difficult for me. And I actually hired a camera crew, because I do think there is something in incredibly beautiful shots, you know, with perfect lighting, and, you know, perfect sound. And for the end of the film, I felt like it was really important to honor Rachel and to give the complete feeling of what was the strength of who she was. Then I needed better camera work than I could do. I think it does. So I'm always in conflict between my own filming, which is sort of content oriented, to hiring people with more camera experience to take it to a different level. So it's still, it's a constant conflict, and I'll, you know, probably go on just being conflicted and doing it in different ways and finding wonderful editors who helped me put it together. My editor, Noam Levy, was, at first I was sort of reluctant to, you know, have a young man, you know, working in the film. I thought, how could he know, you know, or understand? And then I realized that he was a very, very deep and very open and very creative. And I really enjoyed working with him.
Yeah. So would you say that it was really challenging to work with someone that you were so close to personally? Or do you think that that really made the film what it is?
That is such an interesting question. I think there were many times during the filming when I put down the camera, you know, when I just decided to be a person and not a filmmaker, and just, you know, hung out with Rachel for days without filming anything. And I don't know if that made it. I really didn't show anything. You know, there's many more distressful things that I didn't show, because I wanted to protect Rachel and also protect her friends who would see it. So I think, like, some documentary filmmakers would have gone much more into more of, you know, conflicts and distress and things that I didn't want to go into, you know, because I do love her. I don't really know, because I've never made a film about someone that I didn't love. So it's a little...
I think that made it really different than a lot of documentary, like, kind of memoir films that I've seen, because the disease never seemed to defeat her the way that it does in other films, I guess. I thought that was a very cool, it was very cool that you were so close to her, because it showed her resiliency rather than her, I guess, end of life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, look, Rachel also, because of her meditation practice and because of her friendship, she was so talented in friendship. She was so devoted to friendship. She had friends from every stage of her life, you know, from her childhood, from civil rights days, from the Peace Corps. She just had friends. Her home was so full of people. Like it was that they had to have a schedule. She had this fantastic caregiver, Yoshi, who had just every day there were so many people who wanted to see her and be with her. She cultivated, gratitude and friendship. And it's funny because in certain ways I thought, oh God, this is a cruel movie to show during COVID because...
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I realized that some of the most moving, intimate conversations she has are on the phone.
Right.
And, you know, I think ironically, it shows that you can have an intense spiritual connection to someone over the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to say, like, I wonder what her life would have been like during COVID and how she would have felt about that.
Right. Well, I think she would have, look, glioblastoma was her private COVID because it kind of came totally unexpectedly and changed. She was, she couldn't be in the wild nature that she wanted to be in. So she had to imagine nature. She, I think she would have been, you know, very upset by what was going on, with how COVID revealed, such deep rifts in our society, and how I joked, I think I'm not the only person who joked, that she got glioblastoma 3 months after Trump was elected. I think she just her brain could not cope with this. But she, I think even like during her glioblastoma, there was a major vote to repeal Obamacare, and McCain, who also had glioblastoma, was about to cast the vote, and she made a video that went viral, talking about how without Obamacare she would, be without resources. And I don't know if it affected McCain's vote, but we like to think it did. So she was an activist till the end.
I was thinking about her because, like, while watching the film, because I just wonder what her thoughts would have been on everything happening, and how, I feel like she just would have been very powerful in this moment.
So I came across the most incredible clip after I'd finished editing on 9/12. Rachel was on television right after 9/11 with an imam and a priest, and Rachel talking about how after 9/11 you just have to connect. And it was such a beautiful thing to see her, everyone in the studio is in complete shock. You can tell it's just the hugest thing that had happened to anyone there. And, her voice is cracking, but she's just saying, we just have to love one another and go on. And it's very beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Paula, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about your new film. I'm very excited for you that it's, is this the first audience that's going to see it at USC?
At USC, yes. We actually had an opening in the Athena Festival, which is a wonderful women's festival in Manhattan, on March 1st. We had a screening with, hundreds of people, standing room only. And a week later, the city was closed down.
Oh, wow.
So we were very lucky. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on your new film. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's so sweet to meet you. I'm so touched and moved by your words.
Thanks for listening. Have a great week and tune in every Monday for new episodes of Match Volume.